I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
What's the difference between a typeface and a font?
Who were the printer's devils?
And what does it actually mean to be out of sorts?
Crack open a book, get out your press pass, because this episode of Words Unraveled is sure to be just your type. Welcome to another Words Unraveled. I'm Jess Zafaris, author of the etymology books Once Upon a Word and Words from Hell.
And I'm Rob Watts from the YouTube channel Rob Words. And today we're hoping to make a good impression with this episode all about printing and the words that have come from the printing process.
And some typography terms, right? Because I'm very fond of that topic.
Did you just say very fond of it?
I sure did.
Actually, we should get into the difference between a font and a typeface, because that's always something that's something juicy we'll get into. But I think we should start at the beginning of this whole business of typing with the invention of the printing press by Gutenberg. Mm-hmm. But some people get very annoyed if you say that's the start of printing,
right?
Because it's not.
It goes way back. The first movable type system was developed by Chinese inventor Bi Sheng, as far as we know, about 400-500 years before Gutenberg. And by the way, movable type system just means it uses wood and metal type blocks to stamp the shape of letters on paper using a letter press. The big thing with Gutenberg was efficiency, right?
The key difference between what Gutenberg introduced in Europe and what the Chinese were doing is they were doing block typing, block printing, whereas Gutenberg's business with all these tiny little pieces that you can slot together and you can take out and you can rearrange and stuff meant that you could, it was just far more versatile. You could create whatever page you wanted from the same set of pieces.
Part of it was a little like assembly line-ish in the process too. So he treated typesetting and printing as two separate work steps. It made the whole process a lot more efficient. Before, you could print maybe a few thousand, you could print like 40 to 50 pages per day. But after the invention of the Gutenberg press, you could produce up to 3,600 or even 4,000 pages a day, which was much better and definitely better than hand copying.
Yeah, before the invention, Gutenberg's invention, the number of books that have been produced in the entire existence of humanity is in the tens of thousands, probably, but within a century, it's into the millions after the invention, which is rather incredible.
The other thing he did specifically was oil-based ink. Before that, water-based inks wouldn't stick very well to metal type. Obviously, metal type made all the difference here.
Yeah, and using soot as well to give it a really sort of deep, dark, black color as well. And then we have William Caxton. We are indebted to him for producing the first English language books. I mean, he did his sort of training over on the continent in Europe, and then he set up the first printing works in Britain, in London. The first book that he printed, you know what the first book that he printed in English was?
Was it the Gutenberg Bible?
No, it wasn't.
No, what was it?
It was called, so actually this is before he set up his own press. So this was printed on the continent in, 1474, 1475. It was called the Recueil of Histories of Troy, or of the Histories of Troy. And it's a collection of stories about Troy. And it's a translation from French, but we say it's a translation. But the first word of that title, Recueil, does not exist in English at this point. He's basically just anglicized the French word because he doesn't know how to, he can't think of a good translation for the French recueil, which means a collection. So, but he has a good go.
Apparently, if you had a printed book around this time, it may have been colloquially called a Caxton because of his influence.
I also love that he followed up this book of histories of Troy with a book about chess.
I like this. He had his priorities in order.
Yeah, he certainly did. But we should talk about the fact that the printers have a huge influence on the English that we speak today, or indeed the English that we write today, because the establishment of printing presses in England homogenizes the English language to an extent, and the chancery
spelling,
English,
grammar.
Yeah, specifically the way of writing, the way of speaking is reflected on the pages that are printed in London and distributed around the country, to some extent standardizing it based on that.
Dictionaries, style guides, that kind of thing, that was huge. And then being able to disseminate ideas very quickly.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's arguably the most important invention of all time. You can make an argument for that, because without it, you don't get things like the scientific revolution, you don't get the industrial revolution, you don't get the Renaissance in the way that you do get it, because you don't have ways of distributing these ideas. One of the things I think is really amazing, though, about the establishment of the presses, and the fact that there wasn't the skill set in Britain to man them, and it would have been men. So Caxton had to import people from the continent to run his presses. As a result of that, we have a load of spelling changes in English words that are brought about by continental interpretations of English words. For example, the word ghost doesn't have an H in it at all until the printing press arrives in Britain and the Flemish printers presumably start to stick an H in there, because their word geest has an H in it. And so they think, oh, well, that should have an H in it too. And all those words that begin with WH, who, where, what. We pronounce it hua,
right?
Because it was originally an HW word, not a WH word, but It is printers who decide that a language that is so rich in CH words, TH words, SH words, as English is, should also be rich in WH words rather than HW words.
Sounds better that way, I guess.
Yeah, it's amazing. Oh, and also they stick a load of Bs on the end of words to make them match up with one another. Silent Bs that, you know, we don't have.
Plum and thumb and such.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Because words like comb already had them, but thumb did not. And to standardize it, they put them in there. They're also the reason why there's a silent L in could as well, because we know that would and should, grammatically, should have an L in them because of the verbs that they come from, will and shall, basically. Whereas can doesn't have an L in it, does it? But to make it match up, the printers, yeah, stuck an L in could.
Created an inconsistency in one place to create a consistency elsewhere.
They're tinkering. It's not overall helpful, and I think we rue it today. But at the same time, I think that overall impact means that they're a general force for good.
I kind of like those kinds of things, though, because you get to you think, why doesn't that make sense? And then you get to uncover the exciting history of why.
That's what this podcast is all about.
Hey!
When you're talking about the English language, why doesn't that make sense? Let's have a look at it. And there's usually an explanation for it.
One of my favorite things about printing history is because it was so immediately responsible for rapidly disseminating ideas, there was a lot of taboos and superstitions that came up around printing in general. And that appears in the term, one of my favorite jobs or professions of the past is the printer's devil, who was basically, imagine a kid who works in a print shop and he's covered in ink and he's doing all the black fingered drudgery of the printing trade. He would wrangle smudged sheets from the timpan. That's the taut fabric that holds the paper ready, just like a timpani, and then hold it steady while the platen, which is the plate in a letter press, which presses the paper against the type, and then comes down with a big thunk when worn out pieces and broken bits of type were tossed into the place where you would put them afterward, which was called the hell box, because you had to sift through the mess and put everything back in order. You were responsible for that. So there are many theories about why they're called printer's devils. It may have started as a joke, basically, because they're up to their elbows in black ink and look like devils. And sometimes they were even called flies, because they're little urchins and such who were doing this drudge work. But then it could also be a jab from hand copyists who thought that movable type was their ruin, much like AI is an issue for copywriters today, a little demon who helps you do your devilish work of printing. But there's tons of superstition beyond this. So the printing press itself was considered by some to be a tool of the devil. What else could explain the mass production of books, which was once the domain of like scribes and monks? And then early printing houses even had superstitions because they were noisy and they were full of all this like darkness and shouting and clunking and clanking. The superstitions in here included like if you were going to set type backwards, you had to use a mirror or else you would be cursed.
In such an instance, you might need to be minding your P's and Q's.
Right. Exactly.
If I can link us into one of the phrases that we do get from the printing presses, you know, because when you're laying out the type, the sorts, the little pieces are called sorts. And when you're laying them out, they're going to be printed upside down, back to front, and you've got to be very careful that you're picking up the right one, the P or the Q. So you're invited to mind your P's and Q's. Actually, I've got this, haven't I, Jess? Sorry, if I can just show it. For the benefit of the tape, I'm showing what is called The Printer's Vocabulary by Charles Thomas Jacobi. And it is from 1888. And it is just a big list of printer's terms. Well, it has a couple of the ones that you've already mentioned. It's got the printer's devil in here. It's got the hell box. Also, we're talking about snideness. Did you know that the compositors referred to the printers as pigs? Yeah. I think it's quite funny. And so they would refer to the printing room as the pigsty. Anyway, what does it say here? It says, P's and Q's. A novice at case is told to mind his P's and Q's owing to the similarity in shape between the letters. P's and Q's will be closer to one another, obviously, because of where they are in the alphabet. Because otherwise you could say, mind their B's and D's.
But right, of course.
Though they are very close together as well. Not quite as close together. But also, I mentioned that in a video that I did. And a few people got in touch to say that they were under the impression that mind your P's and Q's actually comes from the idea of minding your please and thank yous.
I have heard that one too, but I'm pretty sure it's printing. Like it's older and we have a little more evidence for it.
It is a very elegant alternative explanation though.
That one's cute because it's thank yous, right?
Yeah, exactly. Please and thank yous, P's and Q's.
Mm. Very cute.
Yeah, it's sweet.
Did you know that there's also like a patron devil of printing?
I mean, I've never heard of a patron devil of anything.
Right. I mean, I say that while that is not a term that, you know, regularly comes up in any context. But because these places were so accursed, apparently, there was a devil who would create typos. His name is Titivilus, and he was originally said to introduce errors into the work of scribes as early as the 13th century. So if you made an error and you were a scribe, then it was definitely his fault and not yours. He would also haunt print shops later, and he would invert type, and he would swallow entire lines and make a mess of things, like in 1631 when a Bible was printed that accidentally said, "Thou shalt commit adultery."
That has to be the work of the devil. Another term that I enjoyed from this book of printer's vocabulary is the dirty proof, which is what we call a printed sheet that's just strewn with errors.
My last superstition I have is, so do you know who the financier of Gutenberg's early presses was?
Was it the king?
Well, I mean, probably, but Johann Fust was the one who was originally, who is credited with much of this. And he is also affiliated with superstitions because his name is very close to that of Faust. He was accused of being in league with the devil when he started selling printed books as if they were conjured rather than copied by hand.
Very good. Very good. Like Faust.
Printing's a very dark art, we see. I mean, after all, we do spell things.
Wait, hold on. What's the deal there?
Magic spells are so-called because they are spelled.
Oh, okay. you spell them out.
You're right.
Oh, okay. That's disappointing.
I mean, I think it's kind of cool.
Yeah, well, okay.
The connection between writing and witchcraft is satisfying to me.
We have got printing to thank for a load of other cliches.
Oh, yes.
Sayings. Cliche is one. Cliche is a French term originally. It's the past tense of the verb cliche, but it refers to the sound of casting type, sort of cliche.
Yeah, right. I love that. Yeah. Happy little imitative word.
Cliche is part of a process called stereotyping, which is where you create an entire page so that you save on having to order all of the sorts all over again, for example, if you have another print run later on. And that's where we get the idea of stereotyping, right? You've taken something that already exists in its full form and you've applied it somewhere else as well.
There's like a very famous instance in which they really should have got like ordered stereotypes rather than simply setting the page. This was Ticknor and Fields, American publisher in the 1800s. They printed a book called The Scarlet Letter by Nathaniel Hawthorne, who was popular at the time for like essays and short stories, but this was his first novel. So they ordered a nice large print run of 2,500 copies. That should do it, right? And normally you would only do like 1,000. So you assembled all the individual letters and design elements for each page into a thing that holds type blocks in the shape of a page, which is called a chase. And that makes a full page of type, which is called a form. That's also still why we call, say, filling out a form. And then you use these forms to print several copies of each page. But after you've finished making them, you disassemble the forms so you can reuse the type for something else. But then the Scarlet Letter proves to be so popular that you need to print another 2,500 copies. So they should have ordered stereotypes because that they did exist by this point. And that's this big metal plate. So you can print a lot of copies of Scarlet Letter more easily without worrying about disassembling all your forms. As far as applying it to like modern cultural contexts, the guy there is Walter Lippmann. In 1922, he described recurring cultural behaviors as stereotypes, as different populations emulate practices like the habits of people around them, their parents, the things that are presented to them in media. And he worked in media and publishing. So he called this mental picture a stereotype, this rigid facsimile of life or a narrative that we apply to ourselves that gets repeated over and over again. And therefore, an oversimplified depiction of a whole group of people is a stereotype.
Wow, there you go. There you go. And typecast also has a very similar origin, right? There are plenty more of these, actually, aren't there?
Yeah.
Terms from printing that we use much more broadly.
This one sounds made up, but uppercase and lowercase, right?
Yeah, right? Exactly.
That sounds so made up, but it isn't. Like it's from type foundries.
It's totally true.
You would store the capital letters in the upper part of a type block storage case and drawer, and then the lowercase letters in the lowercase.
Yeah. Majuscule and minuscule.
Exactly,
right?
Yeah.
The words you use before you use the words upper and lowercase. And thus, upper and lowercase only apply to printed text. They do not apply to handwritten text where you've got capitals and little baby letters.
Minuscule letters. There you
majuscule
go.
And minuscule, yeah.
By the way, a capital letter is so called because it stands at the head of a word or sentence. And another fun thing about uppercase and lowercase is it makes sense on typewriters as well, because the uppercase letters are higher up on the type bar, the little stampy thing, than the lowercase letters. And to type a capital letter, one needed to press the shift key to literally shift up the carriage, the round part of the typewriter that carries the paper from side to side, to position it for the letters to land in the correct place from left to right. So the capital letters align with the ribbon.
This is one of the neat things that on our electric keyboards now, we still have keys that are named after their roles on typewriters in particular.
The carriage return, the shift. There's others too, right? I think tab as well.
Yeah, so return is to, you know, return the typewriter carriage, like you say, to the start. So, yeah, the cha-ching bit. So you can start typing again. Shift, alt. Yeah, so that's actually, these are a little bit later than just like the clackety-clackety typewriters, right? But it also allows you to, you know, have an alternative use for a key. Control is quite an interesting one. Control's there to enable you to enter control characters on you know, old-fashioned terminals, you know. So it meant that you could type letters without actually typing any text. And that was the purpose of control. But it's called control because you were inputting control information.
I have this very lovely, I should have brought it in here, but it's very heavy. It's like a 1935 Remington typewriter. I just love it. It only sort of works. I need to have it serviced, but it's a delight.
Yes, and actually I'm wearing this.
Very nice.
Yeah, my wordy nerdy t-shirt with the typewriter on there, which is available in the Words Unraveled shop. You'll find a link below this video or in the description if you're listening to the podcast version.
Should we talk through some font and typography terms?
Please.
Well, first of all...
I don't want to say it like that. I do genuinely want to know.
I know. That's why it was so lovely. Anyway. So I love this stuff. The word font, as in the the style of the letters on your screen and in books, arose in the 1680s as a term used in the printing and movable type industry. To make letters for the press, molten metal was cast in molds in a process called type founding. And the business that did it was called foundries. And it's from the old French fondre, meaning to pour out or to melt, like any kind of metal founding. There are still industrial foundries today that make things like beams and things. Interestingly, also, fondre is also the source of the word fondue.
Yes, yeah, just melting.
It doesn't share a root with the word font, as in fountain, or found, as in foundation, even though it might seem like that. And even though that has to do with pouring as well, so to speak, with the fountain anyway.
And actually, in this book, the word fount is used instead of the word font. Ooh. Throughout. We should mention, by the way, the difference between a font and a typeface. Arial, Helvetica, Times New Roman, are they fonts or typefaces?
Well, okay, so despite the fact that they are used interchangeably today, a font and a typeface are different things if you're working with movable type. Font is a full set of metal character blocks, while typeface describes the overall style of the character design. So you can have a font, a full set of one size and weight of the typeface Helvetica or Times New Roman or Proxima Nova.
So if you want to translate this to when you're typing your Google Docs or whatever, typeface would be Helvetica. Font would be Helvetica 10 points bold,
right,
for example.
Mm-hmm. And a point is what is it, 1/72 of an inch or something like that? I have it somewhere in here.
I know, you're out-nerding me there.
Yes, it's 1/72 of an inch. And then a pica is another typographic unit of measure, which is 1/6 of an inch.
Oh, really?
Oh, I do have another interesting fact here. The Latin pica is the Latin for magpie. It's related to words like piebald and things like that. Like pie is also historically short for magpie. And all of these things indicate things that are essentially jumbled, like a mix of white and magpie-like dark coloring on an animal, and then a jumble of type, for example.
We're talking about a font. The font would be full of little bits called sorts, as we've described. And what happens if for your page you do not have enough of these little sorts? You are out of sorts.
Ah, what?
Yes.
Really?
Indeed. Yeah.
Really?
That is the origin of the term out of sorts, to not have enough letters to complete your page. And what's really interesting, well, what I find really interesting, and hopefully other people will find really interesting, is a font for a page of English text would be different to a font for a page of French text, for example, or for German text. And there's obvious reasons for that. For example, German has this est set, which you wouldn't need in a font for an English text, but also different letters get used more or less often in different languages. For example, you almost never use a W in French, whereas an English font would have quite a lot of W's in it because we use that letter very commonly in where, what, when.
Right. And we use fewer diacriticals and things like that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. So you wouldn't need any of those accented letters or what have you. Yeah. Out of sorts.
Oh, one other fact, we didn't quite fully address it. One of the reasons we call it a typeface is it is literally the face, the symbol or shape on top of the metal or wood type block that makes the impression on the paper when we are printing.
I see.
Mm-hmm. And typing means like strike, essentially, type, figure, image. Well, it means figure, image or form, but also like a blow from the Greek typos.
That is a noun type, or is that the verb type? Or does the verb come from the noun?
The verb comes from the noun.
That's interesting. Okay. One more that we should mention while we're talking about type is the origin of the word logo.
Ooh, yeah.
Which comes from a logogram or a logotype, which is when you cast a piece that has more than one letter on it, or an entire word. That was called a logotype or a logogram. And it was great if, for example, you had a brand name or whatever that you wanted to repeatedly type or to repeatedly put on, I don't know, on stationery or whatever. You'd only need a single sort, a single logogram to do that. Logos is the Greek for word, right? So that means that the Apple logo technically isn't a logo. But the Google logo is.
Ah, excellent, because it doesn't have the logos in it.
Yeah, exactly. Google logo is a word. The Apple logo is an apple, which is not a word. But I mean,
it
Apple
used
is a word,
to. But. It used to have a word. It used to have three words or more in it because it had that little image of Newton sitting underneath a tree.
Did it?
The original Apple logo is this like really elaborate like book plate looking thing that says like Apple Computer Company, and it has a little Newton and an apple shining above his head.
Is that what they're evoking with their name? Then they're evoking the apple that hits Newton on the head.
Correct. Inspiration. Yes. At least for the logo, as far as the logo is concerned.
That's marvelous. Marvelous. Thanks, Jess.
Another advancement in typography and printing was in 1884, the Linotype machine, which allowed entire lines of type to be cast in hot metal at once. It was invented by Otmar Mergenthaler. Mergenthaler. I'm never going to be able to pronounce German names very correctly. You can do that better than I can.
If it's a TH, it's more of a T sound.
Okay, Mergenthaler.
What is it? Mergenthaler?
Much better, thank you.
No props.
But it was the standard in the printing industry for like 80 years after that. And it is an American trademark short for line O type.
What, a line of type?
Yeah.
Line of type. Mm-hmm. Oh, genius.
The way it worked is like the operator would type letters and spaces on a keyboard. The keyboard would select matrices from a magazine that contained molds for each letter. And then they were transported into a mold where they cast the line of type. The line was lifted, moved to a series of grooves where it would drop automatically like into the, I don't know if it was called the hell box at that point, but what was formerly called the hell box.
Yeah, we're bouncing back and forth in time a little bit here through the sort of 4 or 5 centuries where printing presses were at their peak, I guess.
Hey, what is printing history if not time travel? Every time you pick up a book, you're traveling in time.
Oh, wow. That's profound, Jess.
Is it? A couple of interesting and fun type terms. Kerning, for example.
Is that the space between letters?
Yes, that is the space between the individual letters, whereas tracking is, I believe, the entire line. It originates from 17th century typography when it was a little part of a metal type piece extending beyond its body, like the tail of a J, so it would infringe on other lines.
I see. Mm-hmm.
It's from the old French calne, meaning projecting angle or a hinge.
Oh, there you go.
And then we have leading, which is the space between lines of text, which makes more sense in terms of the original meaning of kerning. And that was literally the thin strips of lead placed between lines in metal type.
You know, for a long time, I'd only seen it written down. I thought it was leading.
Leading, right, right.
Okay, but no, it's leading. Yeah, because they're these strips of lead.
Another one that we've talked about when we've talked about ampersands is the ligature, a character that combines two letters into one. In the case of the ampersand, the Latin et, meaning and. And it's from the Latin ligatura, meaning to bind. And it's related to words like alloy, ally, liaison, liable, league, and religion.
And there are more of these ligatures around than you think. I didn't even notice that there are combinations that are often written as a ligature, but you don't notice it. For example, if an I comes after an F, for example, the curve of the F would clash with the dot above the I. So very often it's written as a ligature, but you can barely tell that those two are combined. Because one of the problems with using sorts and typesetting is that you can't really have letters overlapping with one another. And that is why italic text is done with sorts that are slanted so that they can overlap one another. But generally that doesn't happen. And that's why when you do have letters that dangle over the top of one another, then you have no choice but to create a sort of its own.
Italics, by the way, are named after Italy because Aldus Manutius introduced it to Venice in 1501. Originally it was called like Aldine script.
Yeah, and it is based on handwriting, right, in the sort of Italian style, handwriting quite specifically by a right-handed person. Left-handed would be reverse italics, for which we've never really found a use.
We have discussed in previous episodes how it has been suggested as an option for sarcastic formatting, but it hasn't quite worked out.
If you're willing to accept that we need a way to flag up sarcasm, which I think kind of undercuts the whole purpose of it, then, yeah, reverse italics is one of the candidates for how we could do that.
A couple other fun terms from the type space are like the gadzook, which is an embellishment that connects letters in a ligature but isn't originally part of either letter. It's kind of a little fanciful embellishment. And unfortunately, like gadzooks, as you know, is also like a cry of alarm or delight, or I guess dismay as well. And surprisingly, that one has kind of a horrifying origin.
Oh, no.
Do you know what gadzooks is short for?
Is it God's something?
God's hooks, the actual nails on the cross.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
wow.
That's one of the major theories. It could, like, I've also seen the suggestion that it could be God's hawks, but that sounds way weirder.
I was trying to find a link between those two versions of gadzooks, the exclamation and the typographical term, and I couldn't really find one.
I think it's just that it's like a thing.
Yeah.
Kind of like the word swash is also a thing, you know? It's a flourish, a swash.
Flourish, yeah, there we go.
And then a quaint is a connecting stroke between two characters that give it an antique appearance. It makes it look quaint.
A quaint, okay. Which came up in our swearing
sure
episode
did.
As an alternative to another word that sounds slightly similar. By the way, whilst flicking through this book, again, I keep mentioning it, but so we've talked in the past as well about printers having alternative names for punctuation marks, some of which are quite funny. But one that I quite like is that they were commonly in the Victorian era referring to an exclamation mark as an admiration.
Ooh. I rather like that. I feel like only some exclamation points are admirations, though. I mean, if you're excited about something, yes. But if you're, I don't know, angry at it or unpleasantly alarmed by it, not sure we're doing any admiring there.
Yeah, maybe it depends on the specific usage. Yeah. There are lots of fun terms in this printing book. Scroofing is one that I came across. It's a slang expression used to denote searching for scarce sorts.
Ooh.
It's called scroofing around.
Oh, I like that one. I want to use that just regularly.
And can you guess what it means to sop the balls?
No.
So printers would apply the ink to the sorts using these, I think they're sort of leather covered balls, right? That were sort of pads. You go... You'd roll them in the ink and then you go chup, 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 chup. If you put too much ink on your balls, they were said to be sopped. Or as this book describes it, an expression when too much ink was taken on the balls.
You're just not doing me any favors on this one, are you?
It's not funny, Jess.
It's very funny. I am far too immature for this conversation.
There's a reason that one stuck out to me. I don't know why.
That's great. Any other good ones in there?
A cock robin shop was a name for a very small printing house. Correcting nippers is a nice one. Correcting nippers are the tweezers you use to correct type.
I have no business doing this episode.
But that's all I've got.
Oh, fair
enough.
To get us back, to get my mind back on track, I feel like a lot of people might want to talk about or might reference the medial S as kind of an earlier vestige of typing, you know, about when you're reading an old piece of, like, an old piece of writing and a book that's printed before, oh, I don't know, 1900 or something. I don't remember how old it is, but the long S, which looks like an It looks like an F without a crossbar, essentially. So if you've ever been reading an old book and you see something like the word finfulness, you're probably looking at the word sinfulness, because it's usually used to replace kind of like the German symbol. It can replace the single S or one or both of the letters in a double S. It's like a fancy ligature thing. It's supposed to look fancy, but it can be confusing. It's the first half of the grapheme of the German alphabetical ligature.
The SZ. Yeah, exactly. Which literally means SZ. And actually, that's how you make that shape.
It's also sometimes called a swash S. And it is due to like German influence on typing.
Yeah, we see all of these things sort of slipping into English stylistics as a result of the fact that the presses were dominated by Europeans. And also we have them to blame for the fact that we don't have that lovely thorn letter and the fact that we do have ye, where the word the should be sometimes, because it's supposed to be that thorn letter, but the European printers didn't have a thorn in their fonts. So they had a Y, which looked rather similar to it, to their eyes, and used that instead.
Which is so sad because we have such good use for a thorn.
Again, I have t-shirts advocating that we need to bring back the thorn, hardcore thorn. I've made my views on the subject very well known. Absolutely, we should bring back thorn.
I like having both. I would like thorn and eth just for distinctive purposes. But I think the thorn is probably the more useful of the two, especially considering how inconsistently they were interchanged.
Yeah, I don't take Old English as the paradigm, right? Take Icelandic, modern Icelandic, where they use the eth for the th and the thorn for the th. But at the moment, we manage with having th representing both of those. So I would be personally happy as a compromise to just accept thorn replacing th in all contexts as a compromise.
Should we talk about dingbats?
Yeah. What are they?
Dingbats have been many things. The word dingbat has an incredibly wide range of meanings and applications. In 1838, which is when it's first found, it was an alcoholic drink. But it was also a word like what we call a cadigan, a doohickey, a gizmo, a thingamabob, a placeholder name for something whose name we don't know. But throughout the next century and a half, it came to also refer to other things like typographical ornaments used by Hermann Zapf, for example, which became the typeface now known as Zapf Dingbats. It was also a word for a muffin, a woman who is neither your sister nor your mother, a foolish authority figure, and also male genitalia.
What was that about? A muffin being a woman who is not your sister or your mother?
Two separate things. It could be a muffin. A dingbat was a word for a muffin in some bakeries. And then also dingbat was sometimes used as an insulting term for a woman, and you definitely wouldn't use it for someone you were related to.
I see. I got really confused there. Okay.
That was a quote from one of the earlier texts in which it appears, and one of the sillier dictionaries of slang in the past. Unlike now, it is a term for, say, a dingbat, a foolish person, around 1905. And that was probably due to the comic strip The Dingbat Family by George Harriman. Many people in the US might also associate the usage with All in the Family.
Dingbats are sort of a precursor to the emoji, aren't they? They're a way in which you can get little images into lines of text, basically.
Exactly. And I think, have we addressed the fact that emoji is sort of it's not a coincidence, but it's serendipitous at the very least.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Tell us about it again, though.
It is wonderfully serendipitous that the word emoji sounds and looks similar to the Latin-derived English words emotion and emote, because it comes from two Japanese words meaning picture and character, and neither of those words has anything to do with emotions. Now, the reason we use it in the US is because it sounds similar, and it's been widely adopted because those sounds sound alike. But it seems that they were originally called emojis in Japanese, regardless of the fact that they were emoticons, mm-hmm. which is what we originally called them.
Yeah, I remember the transition from the emoticon or the emoticon to the emoji. And I remember at the time thinking, well, basically it's just like a shortened version of the same word. You're just swapping out the J and the T. Right.
I always assumed it was like prior to, I guess I always assumed, I assumed for a short while before I started looking at word origins that it was, I don't know, a combination of a Japanese and an English term, but it is not. It is simply a Japanese term meaning picture character.
That is absurd that it is not related to the word emotion at all.
It's lovely.
Can we just squeeze in a few font names, because they are household names and I have no clue where a lot of the names for fonts, I'm calling them fonts, I should be saying typefaces, I have no idea where they came from.
Font names come from all over the place, largely people and places, but also style, function, and just random whimsy. Many of your favorites are named after places or people. Garamond is named after Claude Garamond, who was a type designer. Baskerville, same for John Baskerville, an 18th century printer and type designer. Caslin is named after William Caslin, an English type founder. Bodoni is an Italian printer. Didot is the French dynasty of printers. For place names, Gotham is inspired by the bold lettering found in New York City signage. We also have, let's see, Helvetica is named after the Latin name for Switzerland. Georgia is after a tabloid headline that read, "Alien heads found in Georgia." The designer, Matthew Carter, liked the name's readability. And then Cairo is named after Egypt's capital because it's a sans serif designed for Arabic script. Let's see, Gil Sands is another typographer. Frutiger was another Swiss creator. Futura, that one's not named after a place. It's reflecting its modernity and forward-looking aesthetic.
No serifs there.
Do you know Times New Roman?
Yes, I know why it's called that as well, because it was invented for the Times, as in the Times of London.
That's
the
correct.
Original one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then Courier is designed retroactively to resemble a typewriter font for the courier industry.
It was originally called Messenger.
Ooh, by
the, by the man who invented it. But on handing it over to IBM, I think, yeah, he decided that courier was better. It was a bit more sort of, a bit fancier than a messenger.
Zapf also created Optima, which is a humanist sans serif design named for its aesthetic balance and clarity.
There's also Verdana, which I know, which is a portmanteau, is it? Yeah, sort of a mix of the word verdant, meaning green, luscious, and Anna, which is the name of the designer's daughter.
Excellent.
So I didn't come with none.
Trajan is inspired by the letter forms on Trajan's Column in Rome, which is kind of interesting. Impact is pretty obvious. It's high impact.
It's quite impactful.
Indeed. Indeed. And I think this has been a rather impactful episode as a whole, has it not?
Very neat. Very nicely done. Yes, indeed. We left our cliches at the door, no stereotypes here, but we're suddenly out of sorts. So let's close up this episode of Words Unraveled. Thank you very much for watching, and thank you very much, Jess.
See you next time.